Send Me to Sleep is a production of Slumber Studios and is made possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors and premium members. If you'd like to listen ad-free and have access to special bonus episodes, you can try out Premium Free for 7 days by following the link in the episode notes. Now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Send Me to Sleep, the place to find a good night's rest. My name's Andrew. Thanks for joining me, and for taking this time for yourself to ensure you get a peaceful night's sleep. Tonight, I'll be reading North and South by Elizabeth Gaskell, chapter 25. In the last chapter, Mr. Thornton expressed his love for Margaret, which Margaret took with offence. In this chapter, Margaret's mother reminisces with her about her brother Frederick's childhood. If you haven't already, find a nice place to get cozy. Take a deep, relaxing breath. And settle your body in whatever way feels most comfortable. Now all you'll need to do is follow the sound of my voice. So let your eyes fall heavy and your breath soften as we settle in for a peaceful night's sleep. Chapter 25. Frederick. Revenge may have her own. Roused discipline aloud proclaims their cause, and injured navies urge their broken laws. Byron. Margaret began to wonder whether all offers were as unexpected beforehand, as distressing at the time of their occurrence, as the two she had had. An involuntary comparison between Mr. Lennox and Mr. Thornton arose in her mind. She had been sorry that an expression of any other feeling than friendship had been lured out by circumstances from Mr. Henry Lennox. That regret was the predominant feeling on the first occasion of her receiving a proposal. She had not felt so stunned, so impressed as she did now, when the echoes of Mr. Thornton's voice yet lingered about the room. In Lennox's case, he seemed for a moment to have slid over the boundary between friendship and love, and the instant afterwards to regret it nearly as much as she did, although for different reasons. In Mr. Thornton's case, as far as Margaret knew, There was no intervening stage of friendship. Their intercourse had been one continued series of opposition. Their opinions clashed, and indeed, she had never perceived that he had cared for her opinions, as belonging to her, the individual. As far as they defied his rock-like power of character, his passionate strength, he seemed to throw them off him with contempt until she felt the weariness of the exertion of making useless protests. And now, he had come, in this strange, wild, passionate way, to make known his love. For, although at first it had struck her that his offer was forced and goaded out of him by sharp compassion for the exposure she had made of herself, which he, like others, might misunderstand, yet, even before he left the room, and certainly not 5 minutes after, the clear conviction dawned upon her, shined bright upon her, that he did love her, that he had loved her, that he would love her. And she shrank and shuddered as under the fascination of some great power, repugnant to her whole previous life. She crept away and hid from his idea. But it was of no use. To parody a line out of Fairfax's Tasso, his strong idea wandered through her thoughts. She disliked him the more for having mastered her inner will. How dared he say that he would love her still, even though she shook him off with contempt? She wished she had spoken more, stronger. Sharp, decisive speeches came thronging into her mind, now that it was too late to utter them. The deep impression made by the interview was like that of a horror in a dream that will not leave the room, although we waken up and rub our eyes and force a stiff, rigid smile upon our lips. It is there, there, cowering and gibbering, with fixed, ghastly eyes, in some corner of the chamber, listening to hear whether we dare to breathe of its presence to anyone. And we dare not, poor cowards that we are. And so she shuddered away from the threat of his enduring love. What did he mean? Had she not the power to daunt him? She would see. It was more daring than became a man to threaten her so. Did he ground it upon the miserable yesterday? If need were, she would do the same tomorrow, by a crippled beggar, willing and gladly, but by him, she would do it, just as bravely, in spite of his deductions and the cold slime of woman's impertinence. She did it because it was right, and simple, and true, to save where she could save, even to try to save. Fasse che due, avine che pura. Hitherto, she had not stirred from where he had left her. No outward circumstances had roused her out of the trance of thought in which she had been plunged by his last words, and by the look of his deep, intense, passionate eyes, as their flame had made her fall before them. She went to the window and threw it open to dispel the oppression which hung around her. Then she went and opened the door, with a sort of impetuous wish to shake off the recollection of the past hour, in the company of others, or in active exertion. But all was profoundly hushed in the noonday stillness of the house, where an invalid catches the unfreshening sleep that is denied to the night hours. Margaret would not be alone. What would she do? Go and see Bessie Higgins, of course, thought she, as the recollection of the message sent the night before flashed into her mind. And away she went. When she got there, she found Bessie lying on the settle, moved close to the fire, though the day was sultry and oppressive. She was laid down quite flat, as if resting languidly after some paroxysm of pain. Margaret felt sure she ought to have the greater freedom of breathing, which a more sitting posture would procure. And, without a word, she raised her up, and so arranged the pillows that Bessie was more at ease, though very languid. "I thought I shouldn't have ever seen you again," said she at last, looking wistfully at Margaret's face. "I'm afraid you're much worse, but I could not have come yesterday. My mother was so ill, for many reasons," said Margaret, colouring. "You may happen think I went beyond my place in sending Mary for you, but the wrangling and the loud voices had just torn me to pieces, and I thought when father left, oh, if I could just hear her voice reading me some words of peace and promise, I could die away into the silence and rest of God, just as a baby is hushed up to sleep by its mother's lullaby. Shall I read you a chapter now?" "Aye, do. Mayhappen I shan't listen to this sense at first. It will seem far away. But when you come to words I like, tut at comforting texts, I'll seem close it my ear, and going through me as it were." Margaret began. Bessie tossed to and fro. If by an effort, she attended for one moment, it seemed as though she were convulsed into double relentlessness the next. At last, she burst out, "Don't go on reading. It's no use. I'm blaspheming all the time in my mind, with thinking angrily on what canna be helped. You'd hear of t' riots may happen, yesterday at Marlborough Mill. Thornton's factory, you know. Your father was not there, was he?" said Margaret, colouring deeply. "Not he. He'd have given his right hand if he had never come to pass. It's that's fretting me. He's fairly knocked down in his mind by it. It's no use telling him. Fools will always break out of bounds. You never saw a man so downhearted as he is." "But why?" asked Margaret. "I don't understand." "Why, you see, he's a committee man on the special strike. T' union appointed him because, though I say it as shouldn't say it, he's reckoned a deep chap, and true to the backbone. And he and t'other committee men laid their plans. They were to hoo together through the thick and thin. What the major part, though, to others were to think, whether they would or no. Whether they would or no. And above all, there was to be no going against the law of the land. Folk would go with them if they saw they'd been striving and starving with dumb patience. But if there was once any noise of fighting and struggling, even with knobsticks, all was up, as they know by to experience of many and many a time before. They would try and get speech at an obstacle and coax them and reason with them and mayhap and warn them off. But whatever came, the committee charged all members at a union to lie down and die, if need were, without striking a blow. And then they reckoned they were sure of carrying the public with them. And besides all that, committee knew they were right in their demand, and they didn't want to have right all mixed up with wrong, till folk couldn't separate it. No more I can the physic powder from t' jelly you gave me to mix it in. Jelly is much the biggest, but powder tastes it all through. Well, I've told you at length about this, but I am tired now. You just think for yourself what it must be for father to have his work undone, and by such a fool as Boucher, who must needs go right against the orders of committee and ruin the strike, just as bad as if he meant to be as Judas. Hey, but father gived it him last night. He went so far as to say he'd go and tell police where they might find t' ringleader of the riot. He'd give him up to mill owners to do what they would with him. He'd show the world that the real leaders of the strike were not such as Boucher, but steady, thoughtful men, good hands and good citizens, who were friendly to law and judgment, and would uphold order, who only wanted their right wage and wouldn't work, even though they starved, till they got 'em. But who would ne'er injure property or life? For, dropping her voice, they do say that Boucher threw a stone at Thornton's sister, that well he killed her.
That's not true, said Margaret. It was not Boucher that had thrown the stone. She went first red, then white.
You'd be there then, were you?
Asked Bessie, languidly, for indeed she had spoken with many pauses, as if speech was unusually difficult to her.
Yes, never mind, go on. Only, it was not Boucher that threw the stone. But what did he answer to your father?
He didna speak words. He were all in such a tremble, with spent passion, I couldna bear to look at him. I heard his breath coming quick, and at one time I thought he were sobbing. But when father said he'd give him up to the police, he gave a great cry, and struck father on face with the claws of his fist, and he were off like lightning. Father was stunned with the blow at first, but for all Boucher were weak with passion and with clemming, he sat down a bit and put his hand afore his eyes, and then made for the door. I don't know where I got the strength, but I threw myself on t' settle and clung to him. Father, father, said I, thou will never go peach on that poor clemmed man. I'll never leave go on thee till thou sayest thou were not. Do not be a fool, says he. Words come readier than deeds to most men. I never thought of telling t' police on him, though by God, he deserves it. And I shouldn't have minded if someone else had done the dirty work and got him clapped up. But now he has strucken me, and I could do it less nor ever, for it would be getting another man to take up my quarrel. But if ever he gets well over this Clemming and is in good condition, he and I will have an up and down fight, purr in Anna, and I'll see what I can do for him. And so Father shook me off, for indeed I was low and faint enough, and his face was all clay white, where it weren't bloody, and turned me sick to look at. And I know not if I slept or waked, or were in a dead swoon, till Mary come in, and I telled her to fetch you to me. And now, do not talk to me, but just read out a chapter. I'm easier in my mind for having spit it out, but I want some thoughts of the world that far away to take the weary taste of it out of my mouth. Read me not a sermon chapter, but a story chapter. They've pictures in 'em, which I see when my eyes are shut. Read about the new heavens and the new earth, and mayhappen I'll forget this. Margaret read in her soft, low voice. Though Bessie's eyes were shut, she was listening for some time, for the moisture of her tears gathered heavy on her eyelashes. At last she slept, with many starts and muttered pleadings. Margaret covered her up and left her, for she had an uneasy consciousness that she might be wanted at home. And yet, until now, it seemed cruel to leave the dying girl. Mrs. Hale was in the drawing room on her daughter's return. It was one of her better days, and she was full of praises of the waterbed. It had been more like the beds at Sir John Beresford's than anything she had slept on since. She did not know how it was, but people seemed to have lost the art of making the same kinds of bed as they used to do in her youth. One would think it was easy enough. There was the same kind of feathers to be had. And yet somehow, till this last night, she did not know when she had had a good sound resting sleep. Mr. Hale suggested that something of the merits of the feather beds of former days might be attributed to the activity of youth, which gave a relish to rest. But this idea was not kindly received by his wife. No, indeed, Mr. Hale. It was those beds at Sir John's. Now, Margaret, you're young enough, and go about in the day. Are the beds comfortable? I appeal to you. Do they give you a feeling of perfect repose when you lie down upon them? Or rather, don't you toss about and try in vain to find an easy position, and wake in the morning as tired as when you went to bed? Margaret laughed. To tell the truth, Mama, I've never thought about my bed at all, what kind it is. I'm so sleepy at night that if I only lie down anywhere, I nap off directly. So I don't think I'm a competent witness. But then, you know, I never had the opportunity of trying Sir John Beresford's beds. I never was at Oxingham. Were you not? Oh, no, to be sure. It was poor darling Fred I took with me, I remember. I only went to Oxingham once after I was married, to your Aunt Shaw's wedding, and poor little Fred was the baby then. And I know Dixon did not like changing from ladies' maids to nurse, and I was afraid that if I took her near her old home and amongst her own people, she might want to leave me. But poor baby was taken ill in Oxingham with his teething, and What with my being a great deal with Anna just before her marriage, and not being very strong myself, Dixon had more of the charge of him than she ever had before, and it made her so fond of him, and she was so proud when he would turn away from everyone else and cling to her, that I don't believe she ever thought of leaving me again. Though it was different from what she'd been accustomed to. Poor Fred. Everybody loved him. He was born with the gift of winning hearts. It makes me think very badly of Captain Reed when I know that he disliked my own dear boy. I think it a certain proof that he had a bad heart. Ah, your poor father, Margaret. He has left the room. He can't bear to hear Fred spoken of. I love to hear about him, Mama. Tell me all you like. You never can tell me too much. Tell me what he was like as a baby. Why, Margaret, you must not be hurt, but he was much prettier than you were. I remember, when I first saw you in Dixon's arms, I said, "Dear, what an ugly little thing." And she said, "It's not every child that's like Master Fred, bless him." Dear, how well I remember it. Then I could have had Fred in my arms every minute of the day, and his cot was close by my bed. And now, Margaret, I don't know where my boy is, and sometimes I think I shall never see him again. Margaret sat down by her mother's sofa on a little stool, and softly took hold of her hand, caressing it and kissing it as if to comfort. Mrs. Hale cried without restraint. At last, she sat straight, stiff up on the sofa, and turning round to her daughter, she said with tearful and almost solemn earnestness, "Margaret, if I can get better, if God lets me have a chance of recovery, it must be through seeing my son Frederick once more. It will waken up all the poor springs of health left in me." She paused and seemed to try and gather strength for something more yet to be said. Her voice was choked as she went on, was quavering as with the contemplation of some strange yet closely present idea. "And Margaret, if I am to die, if I am one of those appointed to die before many weeks are over, I must see my child first. I cannot think how it must be managed, but I charge you, Margaret, as you yourself hope for comfort in your last illness, bring him to me that I may bless him. Only for 5 minutes, Margaret. There could be no danger in 5 minutes. Oh, Margaret, let me see him before I die." Margaret did not think of anything that might be utterly unreasonable in this speech. We do not look for reason or logic in the passionate entreaties of those who are sick unto death. We are stung with the recollection of 1,000 slighted opportunities of fulfilling the wishes of those who will soon pass away. And do they ask us for the future happiness of our lives? We lay it at their feet and will it away from us. But this wish of Mrs. Hale's was so natural, so just, so right to both parties, that Margaret felt as if, on Frederick's account, as well as on her mother's, she ought to overlook all intermediate chances of danger, and pledge herself to do everything in her power for its realization. The large, pleading, dilated eyes were fixed upon her wistfully, steady in their gaze, though the poor white lips quivered like those of a child. Margaret gently rose up and stood opposite to her frail mother, so that she might gather the secure fulfillment of her wish from the calm steadiness of her daughter's face. "Mama, I will write tonight and tell Frederick what you say. I am as sure that he will come directly to us as I am sure of my life. But easy, Mama. You shall see him as far as anything earthly can be promised. You will write tonight. Oh, Margaret, the post goes out at 5. You will write by it, won't you? I have so few hours left. I feel, dear, as if I should not recover, though sometimes your father over-persuades me into hoping. You will write directly, won't you? Don't lose a single post, for just by that very post I may miss him. But Mama, Papa is out. Papa is out, and what then? Do you mean that he would deny me this last wish, Margaret? Why, I should not be ill, be dying, if he had not taken me away from Helston to this unhealthy, smoky, sunless place. Oh, Mama, said Margaret. Yes, it is so indeed. He knows it himself. He has said so many times. He would do anything for me. You don't mean he would refuse me this last wish, prayer, if you will. And indeed, Margaret, the longing to see Frederick stands between me and God. I cannot pray till I have this one thing. Indeed, I cannot. Don't lose time, dear, dear Margaret. Write by this very next post. Then he may be here, here in 22 days, for he is sure to come. No cords or chains can keep him. In 22 days, I shall see my boy. She fell back, and for a short time, she took no notice of the fact that Margaret sat motionless, her hand shading her eyes. You are not writing, said her mother at last. Bring me some pens and paper. I will try and write myself. She sat up, trembling all over with feverish eagerness. Margaret took her hand down and looked at her mother sadly. Only wait till Papa comes in. Let us ask him how best to do it. You promised, Margaret. Not a quarter of an hour ago, you said he should come. And so he shall, Mama. Don't cry, my own dear mother. I'll write here, now. You shall see me write, and it shall go by this very post. And if Papa thinks fit, he can write again when he comes in. It is only a day's delay. Oh, Mama, don't cry so pitifully. It cuts me to the heart. Mrs. Hale could not stop her tears. They came hysterically, and, in truth, she made no effort to control them, but rather called up all the pictures of the happy past and the probable future, painting the scene when she could lie a corpse with the son she had longed to see in life weeping over her, and she, unconscious of his presence, till she was melted by self-pity into a state of sobbing and exhaustion, that made Margaret's heart ache. But at last, she was calm and greedily watched her daughter as she began her letter. Wrote it with swift, urgent entreaty, sealed it up hurriedly, for fear her mother should ask to see it, and then, to make security most sure, at Mrs. Hale's own bidding, she took it herself to the post office. She was coming home when her father overtook her. "And where have you been, my pretty maid?" asked he. "To the post office with a letter. A letter to Frederick." "Oh, Papa, I have done wrong, but Mama was seized with such a passionate yearning to see him. She said it would make her well again, and then she said that she must see him before she died. I cannot tell you how urgent she was. Did I do wrong?" Mr. Hale did not reply at first. Then he said, "You should have waited till I came in, Margaret." "I tried to persuade her." And then she went silent. "I don't know," said Mr. Hale after a pause. "She ought to see him if she wishes it so much, for I believe it would do her much more good than all the doctor's medicine, and perhaps set her up altogether. But the danger to him, I'm afraid, is very great. All these years since mutiny, Papa." "Yes, it is necessary, of course, for government to take very stringent measures for the repression of offences against authority, more particularly in the Navy, where a commanding officer needs to be surrounded in his men's eyes with a vivid consciousness of all the power there is at home to back him, and take up his cause, and avenge any injuries offered to him, if it need be. Ah, it's no matter to them how far their authorities have tyrannized, gallied hasty tempers to madness. Or if that can be any excuse afterwards, it is never allowed for in the first instance. They spare no expense. They send out ships. They scour the seas to lay hold of the offenders. The lapse of years does not wash out the memory of the offence. It is a fresh and vivid crime on the Admiralty books till it is blotted out by blood." "Oh, Papa, what have I done? And yet it seemed so right at the time. I'm sure Frederick himself would run the risk." "So he would. So he should. Nay, Margaret, I'm glad it is done, though I durst not have done it myself. I'm thankful it is as it is. I should have hesitated till, perhaps, it might have been too late to do any good. Dear Margaret, you have done what is right about it, and the end is beyond our control." It was all very well, but her father's account of the relentless manner in which mutinies were punished made Margaret shiver and creep. If she had decoyed her brother home to blot out the memory of his error by his blood, she saw her father's anxiety lap deeper than the source of his latter cheering words. She took his arm and walked home pensively and wearily by his side.